Welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week, we have a conversation with Thiago Alexander Fernandes Mauricio, our Portuguese associate editor for the Forgotten Naval Strategist Week. He's living in Tokyo right now, and part of his time is spent working on a translation of the works of Portuguese naval strategist Fernando Oliveira. This will be the first English translation, so congrats to him. Our discussion covers Fernando Oliveira, as well as some of the other forgotten naval strategists, or those who we call forgotten naval strategists during the week. Part of the question we ask ourselves is why some of these folks might be forgotten. We also throw in a bit about the Peloponnesian War, because why not? Peloponnesian War is pretty great. And when I say great, I don't mean it was great that there was a Peloponnesian War. Granted, the Peloponnesian War was kind of horrible. Lots of people died and there was a plague. But great because the history of the Peloponnesian War is a really great book. This is a good opportunity with these forgotten naval strategists to take a step back and look where some of the naval strategy we discuss comes from. And perhaps some ideas that we may or may not have missed along the way. Thiago's a great guest, and he is just a font of information. I loved having him on, and I invite you to kick back, relax, and we'll be back with you after a short break.
Do you like the Sea Control Podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
And we are back for our podcast on the Forgotten Strategist series. I am here with Thiago Alexander Fernandes Mauricio, who is in Tokyo. Thiago, you were the associate editor for personally one of my favorite weeks here, helping with the Forgotten Strategist, which I think was one of the most educational, because a lot of what we talk about, people talk about on a regular basis, and a lot of these people are new faces. But before we get into the regular part of the podcast, of us, tell us about yourself, where are you coming from, kind of what's your background, and what brought you into this whole study of maritime strategy?
Good evening, Matt. It is indeed a rather long name, so I do apologize for that. But my name is Thiago Mauricio, for short. I come from Portugal, and I'm currently living in Tokyo, as you just mentioned, doing research on military exercises and deterrence in Northeast Asia. So I'm also a WSD Honda Fellow at Pacific Forum CSIS and an analyst at Wikistrat. But prior to that, I've spent 2 years at Kyoto University, also in Japan, doing research on Northeast Asian security after taking my MA in War Studies at King's College London. Before that, I did my BA in Portugal and partly in Brazil, having interned at the Portuguese Navy staff, particularly the Policy Planning Division, and also at the Military Affairs Office at the Portuguese Embassy in Brazil. So now I'm finishing my second master's at Waseda University. And I became particularly interested in the work of Fernando Oliveira. Your pronunciation was spot on. mostly due to the fact that because of Portugal's long-lasting and quite important maritime tradition, I struggled as I studied it to find a maritime treatise that would ever explain the strategic fundamentals of that maritime empire, which was the first in European history, not only in its scope, but also in its breadth and its impact in world affairs. So it was only when doing that background reading that I found the work of this much understudied and under-researched figure, Fernando Oliveira, quite a controversial character at that too. And then his perhaps most famous book, The Art of War at Sea, dated 1555, that really contained all the essentials that I was looking for to explain the period of naval warfare that started in the 1500s onwards.
So first, let me say, I did not say your name was too long. I merely said it didn't match its location very well. So I had one or two more questions about kind of how you got into this, but you mentioned first that Fernando Oliveira, I don't think I pronounced it for the audience. I think that was pre-podcast. But so you did study this, one of our first forgotten strategists, and you mentioned he was controversial. Maybe you can flesh that out a little bit.
Yes, well, if you do indulge me in 1 minute or two to explain the basics of Oliveira's life, I'll do explain that.
Please.
Part of what I'm about to say has already been mentioned in an article for the recent series, Forgotten Navalists or Strategists at SIMSEC, where Commander Nuno Sardinha Monteiro of the Portuguese Navy lays out some of the main facts about the life and work of Father Oliveira. But just hear me out on a couple of things which I think are worthy elaboration. Father Oliveira, I think, is the quintessential representative of the 16th century. A humanist, a sailor, a strategist, also an adventurer, first and foremost. I think he encapsulates all that was old and new about a period in Portuguese and indeed European history when the boundaries of power and imagination were expanding massively. So I think in this sense, he is worthy of study on his own right, not just for his writings on maritime strategy. I only wish he had visited the Orient, for that would surely have given him a truly universal scope. As it happened, he didn't visit the Orient, and he was mostly confined to the European theater. But in more practical terms, he was born in Portugal in 1507 and began his studies at the Dominican Seminary, hence Father Oliveira. In his mid-20s, he abandons the order and sought refuge in Castile, modern-day Spain, where he subsequently obtained his secularization from the church. He then returns to Portugal for a few years and publishes, the first treatise on Portuguese grammar. By the 1540s, he embarks on a trip to Barcelona and then to Genova, Italy, where he is supposed to have participated in a diplomatic mission to the Spanish court and the papacy, Vatican City. And some even assume that he was some sort of spy, or at least he represented some of the roles of gathering intelligence and information about foreign courts. That's where things become especially interesting for us, because in one of the many naval encounters in the Mediterranean that often pitted Catholics against Ottomans or Moors, he's taken hostage not by Muslims, but by a flotilla of French galleys. Surprisingly, Oliveira becomes a pilot aboard one of those warships. A few years pass by when it's believed that he engaged in further French operations in the Mediterranean theater until he returns to Portugal with the representative of a pope, so not as a fettered oarsman in a galley in a very improper condition, which somewhat attests to his skilled seamanship and nautical expertise. So by this point, readers and the listeners would have realized that he's not a typical fellow. So owing to his restlessness and his knowledge on maritime sciences, he immediately seeks further adventures, obviously, until he is hired as a pilot by another French expedition in the mid-1540s. So coming out of Marseille in France to engage the English in commerce raiding along the Channel. So in yet another turn of events, an exciting one, he's taken hostage yet again and sent to England, where against normal, let's call it prisoner conventions, he advises the English shipbuilders to improve the design and construction of their ships, while at the same time maintaining an active correspondence with Portuguese noblemen, including relaying one letter from King Edward VI, of England to King John III of Portugal. So after release, and I'll keep it at that, after release he returns to Portugal and sees himself prosecuted by the Inquisition on charges of heresy for some public remarks about religious affairs and assumedly holy wars, which he does talk about in the beginning of his book, The Art of War at Sea. And after interrogations and penitence, he is sent to a convent, but yet again sets sail in the early 1550s as a chaplain in another expedition, a Portuguese one, to reinstate the old king of Valais, an ally of Portugal in modern-day Morocco, the Atlantic shore of Morocco. The military campaign then turns into a debacle, and the five Portuguese ships are taken captive by the enemy. Yet again, contradicting the so-called prisoner conventions, Oliveira is then temporarily appointed the chief negotiator of the hostage release until he's sidetracked for improper conduct, We still don't know what that means. But, so then Safe and Sound, back in Portugal, he then publishes his Art of War at Sea in 1555, which is, I think, the first treatise on maritime strategy, followed by another treatise on shipbuilding written in Latin in 1570 called Ars Nautica, or The Art of Navigation, and a sequel to that now in Portuguese called the Book translation would be A Book on Building of Ships of around 1580. And that's that.
Man, something must have been going on in Iberia around this point in time, because he's almost like the negative image of St. Ignatius, who is also from Iberia. So you've got one guy who's like, I'm bored being a priest, I'm going to go on adventures. And then the other guy who's like, I've gone on so many adventures, now I'm going to become a priest. But they're all coming out of Spain and Portugal. But so what is it that got you interested in this field in particular? So you sort of brought this up. The iWeek was inspired by your article on Oliveira. So at what point in time in your life, where did you get into this and say, man, maritime strategy, maritime security is something I want to look at?
It first started a couple of years ago as I was interning at the Portuguese Navy staff, when in some of their strategic documents, quotes by Fernando Oliveira starting popping up. And it was interesting to know what was actually behind all the quoting and to see how fundamental the book was and his writings were for us to understand maritime strategy. So this happened around about 5 years ago. And then during my studies at King's, I had the opportunity to host an event with an admiral of the Portuguese Navy, then the deputy vice chief of staff, Admiral António Silva Ribeiro, who was very much responsible for the rehabilitation of Fernando Oliveira in modern-day strategic studies in Portugal. So there he did a presentation on the life and work of Fernando Oliveira before the audience of the War Studies Department, including Professor Andrew Lambert, a very renowned military historian. And because of the exchanges that we had during that seminar, it was generally agreed upon that it would be very valuable for us to have an English translation of that book. So around about that time again, my translation efforts have begun. In the meantime, I know that I've taken somewhat a long time to do it, but life happens and I had other projects in mind and more pressing ones. So it's only now that I'm reaching the final stages of this translation, and hopefully the book will be hitting the bookshelves somewhat soon.
Well, that would be excellent, and at the risk of inspiring the wrath of B.J. Armstrong of Mahanian fame, you're like the Portuguese version of him, except obviously your strategist sounds like a slightly better job than randomly running a ship into objects all over the Atlantic. Did you have any of the articles that this week kind of popped out to you, or any of the thinkers? We had a number on a number of different strategists of varying level of fame. I would probably say that you guys are the winner, Oliveira, of someone that nobody, at least most sort of in our field, at least in amongst folks that speak pretty much just English, haven't heard of Oliveira. But did anything stand out during the week that you thought was particularly interesting that sort of stood out to you?
First of all, thank you for the kind remarks. I must say that one of them did caught my eye. That was The Paradox of Admiral Gorshkov by Jessica Huckabee from the Institute of Defense Analysis, if I'm not mistaken, in which she makes the case that some navalists are indeed forgotten, but some of them probably deserve to be. And the whole argument about Admiral Gorshkov was that his ideas were, although important for the Cold War period, in shaping Western perceptions, particularly American perceptions of Soviet naval power, Admiral Gorshkov's works perhaps don't have as much relevance these days. So there's a good reason why he became forgotten, and probably, she argues, he will remain forgotten. Some other examples have included Themistocles, Admiral Fisher of First World War fame, the great modernizer of the Royal Navy, transitioning it to the dreadnought era. Which also was very, very interesting because it makes the parallel, which I explicitly stated in the call for articles, that we should diversify our sources of strategic inspiration and move away from Alfred Mahan and Sir Julian Corbett. And then in this article on Fisher, it makes the case that behind Corbett, there was this Admiral Fisher that was very much a man of action and enacted some of the strategic ideas, not only of his own, but also of Corbett, into translating strategic principles into naval action. So that was also very interesting and worthwhile reading.
And translating battleships into cruisers, and that didn't work out too well, but oh well. The thing that struck me the most about the Gorshkov article was actually the fact that he was CNO, essentially, of the Russian Navy for 29 years. As a sort of a side point, our discussion of strategists, just this idea that a single individual for 29 years, roughly, had control over the strategic vision of a naval institution. And I thought that was particularly striking. Nothing particularly about his strategy in that regard, but just how much different. Imagine if the United States Navy had the same CNO for 29 years. How the procurement process would be different. Not that this would necessarily be good, because maybe you'd get an Admiral Fisher and you'd get absolutely nothing but battle cruisers everywhere all the time, so that when it came time to fight, they'd all explode. So diversity does have its value. But I thought that was particularly interesting. What other sort of strategists have you run into or considered in your looking into Oliveira?
As I've said, I'm mostly interested in that specific period of Portuguese and European history. And during that period, you don't really find so many writers talking and writing strategically about issues of maritime affairs and we would call these days national security. So in this sense, Father Fernando Oliveira does stand out as one of the singular figures of the 16th century in discussing these affairs. I remember you saying that you had an interest in writing about Hugo Grotius, who also had somewhat of a strategic vision about the maritime commons, and that I would very much be looking forward to reading. But as it stands out, this work of translation has been a standalone practice. I've been focusing mostly on the book itself, devising the best accurate translation that I can possibly make for a modern audience, of course, because I think that's where the value of the book is, in improving our understanding of current and future challenges, because history for history's sake, I think, is nothing but an antiquary's pastime. So I don't really have the intention of translating this book and putting it back into the dustbin of history. I want people to read it and to use it in contemporary debates about naval strategy.
Oh, absolutely. And it deserves to be so because of how early these thoughts. You bring up the Hugo Grotius piece. I'm in the middle of JPME now. For everyone else that doesn't know what that is, it's a joint professional military education. So I'm reading like 400, 500 pages of stuff a week. They say the reading's only hard if you do it, and well, I guess I do because I like it. To Matt Marighi's Themistocles piece is this iteration of strategic concepts where you almost leave people behind. Like Oliveira or Themistocles. Maybe Themistocles not so much, because the history of the Peloponnesian War is such a pivot. That it's, I mean, everything, the book, is, in my personal opinion, is that every single naval officer should read that entire book at some point in time as part of their pre-commissioning education. Because if you mm-hmm. you go through it, there's power projection, there's presence, there's a certain point where asymmetry becomes a massive problem for the Athenians in the Great Harbor, and the response is essentially, and you see it in your head, you're like, wow, this is like a Department of Defense, like Tiffany attempt to build this high-end product. The Syracusans go out, stick some posts in the water that mess with the Athenian trimarans, and the Athenian response is to build an uber anti-post ship that costs a bunch of money and has to be defended against archers. And you're like, wow, these guys are spending dimes to your $100 bills on the ability to restrict your maneuver to deny you access, anti-access, area denial kind of stuff. And, like, this is happening right here, and we act today like A2AD is a new thing. And you're like, well, it kind of happened to the Athenians at a certain point. And so many of these, I'm sure it's language. You know, Thucydides got translated. Hugo Grotius got translated. Oliveira, unfortunately, didn't. So I think maybe that could be a number of our strategists, like Liu Huoqing. I'm sorry for everyone from China or that knows how to speak Chinese and how I just butchered the guy's name. But Daniel Hartnett wrote a great piece on the father of the Chinese Navy, and I wonder if it's really in the West, it's a language barrier, is that we pretend like these are our forgotten strategists, but you know, Tiago, the Portuguese Navy hasn't forgotten Oliveira. They quote them, as you said, in their documents. So, forgotten for whom, I suppose, is the question. But I guess that's just the nature of life. You know, which is the biggest market, and can people in that market understand what you're saying? But it's a shame works like that sort of are rebuilt. You know, it's like work that's already done, people should get credit for it, and yet, you know, they get lost, and then it gets reinvented. So,
I think to credit the discussion that has followed the publication of my own article on Fernando Oliveira, and then Commander Sardinia Monteiro's article, I think there's this general acknowledgement that in the process of European history, and modern European history particularly, Portugal does stand in a special place in terms of maritime power. Because it was one of the first of the European maritime powers. Absolutely. With a global reach, together with the Spanish, then followed by the Dutch, by the English, and then lastly by the Americans. So there's this genealogy of maritime strategy, which should be salvaged, should be rehabilitated, and should be given more attention, if provided that some of the books are indeed available to a wider audience. And these days, in English, that's the lingua franca, that's the one we have to communicate by.
Describe, that's such a beautiful mix to say that English is the lingua franca. Just to think about it, you're like, wait, what? It's the English is the French. Okay, well, that works for me. you know what? I was just thinking about this while we're sitting here talking off the topic of forgotten strategists, but something forgotten that's kind of to be appreciated is that you are, as I said, in Tokyo. I'm here in Norfolk. It's just, we're having this conversation across how many thousands of miles of undersea cables, and it's instantaneous. That's wild. Mm-hmm. Just, we assume that maritime security, and we talk about all this strategy being sea lines of communication on top of the sea, but I think a lot of folks forget about the number, like, this is just a piece of infrastructure. You know, this is cable laid under the sea. I'm not an engineer, so it blows my mind just that we're able to accomplish a feat like that.
It's quite interesting also by living here in Japan that I do realize that very much the whole naval debate has turned quite hot in the region, Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia including. And that even within Japan's security establishment, you see debates and concerns about the fact that Japan is indeed an archipelagic nation. It needs to be connected to the outside world by many different ways. Sea lines of communication is one of them. But also those underlying cables, underwater cables, is also a great part of that equation in order to connect not just the people, but also the financial system, even the government. So a greater concern, I think, is to be found amongst national security experts with the military developments in the region that can precisely attack those underwater cables and therefore remove Japan off of the grid, so to speak. So it's very interesting to see how not just geography, but also history and technology are now merging into this very dynamic naval debate. and to see what some of the solutions are being put forward can tackle that issue. So it's a very exciting time to be here, and that's why I'm here.
So I think this is a great question to close on then, is having said that, so you are in the midst of what we all acknowledge is a very rich naval debate, debate about defense in Japan, is that listening to this debate and having read the works of Oliveira, are you pulling anything out, these enduring aspects that he talked about or ideas that he spoke about, that you're listening to the modern day debate and you're going, oh, you know, I recognize that and I can see that in his works?
Oh, very much so. Because his book is divided into two parts, each with 15 chapters, in which he talks about all sorts of different métiers, different matters of naval affairs, from logistics to communication, intelligence, leadership, recruitment and training of troops. There are so many different pearls of wisdom found in that book, that it's very difficult not to make the parallels and wonder what he would have said about the current naval dynamics here in the region, and indeed at the world at large. So issues like the location of the fight, how to put battles, how to fight battles at sea, and some of their risks. I'm just quoting some of the titles of the chapters here, on the awareness of provisioning and therefore of logistics, the necessity of war at sea and why it's so central to the state, some of the general rules of war, all of these topics, all of these issues, and the way he lays them out have very much a deep resonance with the current security debates here in the region. Although I would warn against direct parallels on the risk that they might be anachronic, because there is a little bit of dated wisdom found in the book, because he was obviously talking about the age of sail and the age of galleys, which these days might not have so much relevance. But indeed, in the broadest sense, his strategic wisdom does prevail. I think there are some perennial aspects to maritime strategy and to strategy at large that survive all the technological change and changes in political context, which should be very much borne in mind when discussing current affairs. So I think, and this is what I mentioned earlier, that I hope that this book does illuminate some of the questions pertaining to national security and to strategy in order for us to better understand what's going on.
You know, you've just reminded me, I was reading Thucydides, and I was going to go out and suggest that, you know, warships started smashing, you know, port to starboard side, you know, so you could get hoplites onto the... But then you're right, that is anachronistic. That's a horrible plan. I was probably taking it slightly too seriously. I'm awful at it's a terrible joke. It's early in the morning for you, it's late in the evening for me. So we'll chalk that one up as a loss. Well, Tiago, thank you so much for joining me for the podcast, especially at such short notice. For everyone else that's listening to, we have to give them credit. You've had what, 4 hours of sleep? We had to extend this by about 2 hours because I was worried you'd come on here with only three, and then we'd sort of be up a creek here with you with no sleep.
And another problem. It comes with the territory, I believe.
There you go. Well, you know, it's you either be or to do, as Colonel Boyd would say. So you can be asleep or do, and I guess you've chosen to do. Is there anything that you have that you're thinking about, books that you've read, things that you would suggest folks to look into? Real quick, if anyone's interested, we will soon have, hopefully, we've got a new e-intern that's going to be working on putting all of the Forgotten Strategist pieces together into a PDF booklet that we'll make available somewhere for people to download. But, Tiago, is there anything out there that you think people should go to, that they should read, or other articles that you've read recently that you would recommend?
On the first topic of what to look forward to, I'll be writing another article for SimSec sometime soon, within the next couple of weeks, in which I'll try to expand some of the strategic principles of Oliveira to give it a more a meat. For those that have asked when the translation will be published, hopefully next year, so I try to be as fast as possible. As far as readings are concerned, I have a couple of suggestions of readings I've done recently. I think The Grand Strategy of the Byzantine Empire by Edward Luckvack is an instant classic and worthy of your attention. And then I have many other books that pertain mostly to Japanese security that ought to be attractive to many people, especially these days when Japan is revising together with the United States their alliance guidelines, and then will therefore reshape the whole profile of the alliance in this region, which I think is one of the pivotal foundations of national security architecture in the region. So I'll perhaps recommend only Richard Samuel's Securing Japan, Grand Strategies of Tokyo for National Security. I think it's compulsory reading. I'll keep it at that.
All right. Well, Tiago, thank you so much for joining us, and look forward to seeing your translation.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. It was an honor.